slaves to the king. Six new moons of the year. He pockets our blood and our sweat, leaves us to our tears. More, lawmakers cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. We shall not stand down.
And welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. You're listening to the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. And for you who are new to this hour, you're tuned into WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station, for over 49 years because listeners like yourselves choose to support the station. And for that, I join programmers and staff in expressing my gratitude. We bring you Jazz and Justice for the purpose of building better communities, one broadcast at a time. And again, for our new listeners, We the People is a weekly news magazine. It deals with the issues of race, history, politics, and culture, particularly where they intersect, particularly where groups of people or individuals have worked with diligent efforts to make life better for us all. Part of that story will be what we do today. We are joined by Nicole Lefevre. They are an activist, an award-winning journalist, and writer. And in 2004, Nicole Lefevre became the first openly LGBTQ plus member of the Idaho legislature, elected four times, and finally serving as state senator. They eventually led multiple acts of civil disobedience at the state capitol, and we'll find out why. Their memoir, In the Arms of the Mountains, a memoir of land, love, and queer resistance in rural America, is the basis of our conversation. And good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, David. It's a delight to be here.
And I'm glad to have you with us. There's so much to cover. You richly share from this memoir of yours. Again, In the Arms of Mountains, a memoir of land, love, and queer resistance in rural America. And we all begin our journey with something formative early in our lives. What I took notice of is your remarkable relationship to nature. Can you really just talk about that, the childhood of being very attuned, very much in place with nature?
I think some of that came from my father, but a lot of it came from just living in a house at the edge of forests and sagebrush and learning to go out alone. I think a lot of people don't get that opportunity to just be in solitude out there and let it wash over you and figure out how small and sometimes how humble it makes you.
And that first started out in Colorado, but then you wound up in Idaho. Can you fill in some details about that as well?
I think my dad thought Idaho was going to end up being a little more progressive place than Aspen. He was one of those counterculture folks, lived in the neighborhood with Hunter S. Thompson. He was pretty tired of the kind of oppressive conformity of Aspen at the time, and thought that Idaho would be a lot more free. I think, as we all know from the news, if you listen, that hasn't recently turned out to be the case.
Indeed. Let's dig in some more. Alone in the Wilderness, a Wonderful Solitude. What, you know, this is the medium of airwaves and not visual, but what is it that's memorable for you in relating to nature? How did it contribute to your person?
I think very powerful for me was working in the wild, like deep wild, like hours and hours of walking away from any road, and spending a night out there utterly alone, having those moments of terror at the sounds that were foreign, and worrying that I wouldn't be able to bear the solitude, but making it through to morning and realizing just how miraculous that felt and how much in the end, after days and days and then weeks and then years of that, I felt part of it. I felt a certain degree of respect between myself and some of the creatures around me, like mountain lions and the ravens and even wolves.
Yeah. And so the yellow eyes at night peering out at you through trees and bushes is not necessarily a deadly threat, but something that offers a sense of wonder, no doubt. And you enjoyed that with your sister and your mom and dad as well. They each had their own way of relating to nature, I guess.
I'm sure that we all do. You know, and maybe we have that one moment in our heads, like for me, standing in a avalanche chute on a trail and listening to a wolverine just up the hill from me, kind of screaming at me that I should leave. And just having that sense that I'm small and it's not my place. I'm visiting.
So this is, again, an early marker in your life. You know, I deliberately welcome you as a guest because, you know, the minute we say Idaho, we think of, you know, a red state and red America. And we might think of the vastness of land as such, but all these things are terribly complex. And I'll stick with the nature thing because I don't know if I'm going to succeed at doing this in this hour, but those reflections about nature, to me, it seems so essential to your story as far as dealing with other human beings, dealing with political life as well. The bridge question is this. For those of us who, you know, we may be near a park or a forest, but for the most part, we're not going to be able to take advantage of a mountain state like Idaho. What is it that you want to extend? If you could encapsulate it in a message to our listeners, what is it that we could be mindful of, we could appreciate, or maybe think of our country in different terms?
I would say that nature, I see it as just the persistence of life in spite of us, right? Nature is everywhere. It's in the sidewalk cracks. It's in the parking lots. It sure is in the parks. I love the idea of, you know, learning the native plants that belong to the area where you are and seeing if you can get with your parks folks to get more of them to grow. Because when they do, then the insects come back and the birds come back and the small creatures come back. And you start to see patterns. And I guess that's another really powerful thing about nature is when you watch enough, you start to see things you never saw before. When you listen, when you smell, when you watch the change of the seasons, that's there for all of us. And we're a part of it in a way, but we're also in a role where we have so much power to wreak havoc. And our respect for it is so important and so beautiful when it happens. I pull weeds a lot of the day. I really do. I love to just like clear a little place for a native plant I find and just hope that it thrives.
And you said you pull weeds. Is there a problem with invasive species in Idaho?
There are.
Yeah, we hear on the East Coast, bamboo seems to be all over the place, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah. Yeah. And I try to remind myself, I mean, I will spend hours and hours pulling weeds in a place that is all weeds. And I don't give up because sometimes that one plant that is able to bloom and produce its own seeds produces seeds that will be there for potentially generations and generations and millennia. And that little act of clearing a space for it is pretty powerful and a good metaphor for all of our work to do with the world we live in.
Well, speaking of which, let me lump together the nature aspect of your life and say that one of the amazing things is that you were a lookout for forest fires, and also a wilderness ranger. Why don't you introduce us to both of those experiences, and we'll dig in further.
So when you're a fire lookout, they pack you in a couple months worth of food on the back of a mule and haul you up a mountain, or take you in by helicopter. My first year as a fire lookout, I was taken in by helicopter and just set on top of a peak that had a road to it, but the road was closed by snow. And so you live up there for a couple of months. And if you're in the backcountry where they take you by mule, you might not see anybody for, a month at a time. Nobody, no human. So your ability to be attuned to everything else becomes pretty powerful.
And all this was at the Frank Church River of No Return National Park in Idaho?
In the wilderness area, yeah. Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness.
Wow, and what a distinctive name. I'm old enough to remember Senator Church and that he was a champion of environmental causes as well as other progressive concerns as well. I understand that landmass that you had some stewardship over is about, 2.3 million acres. And
yeah,
it's probably the largest federal managed land outside of Alaska. And I don't know how your fellow citizens of Idaho felt about federal management, but it might be a good time to talk about that. Was that a job well received? I get the point that you probably were individually respected, but the whole task of managing that vastness of land, did it indeed belong to everybody, or did it belong to the people who were in proximity?
You know, it was kind of fascinating, the moment at which I began that work for the federal government in the wilderness was the rise of the wise use movement, which was kind of a radicalizing industry-funded movement to reduce regulation. I mean, we see this a lot now in every way. I mean, on discrimination, on all kinds of aspects of human safety, but also in protection of the land. And so I was met with a shotgun or two in my time, checking water quality near a ranch, or when I was in the backcountry, folks would be back there in hunting season and I'd be alone. And I'd, come upon groups of heavily drinking men or folks who wanted to run their chainsaw or their ORV without being bothered by somebody who to them embodied the federal government. And this place that I landed when I was 11, I didn't realize was above all very libertarian and very anti-government.
And you mentioned that from childhood to tweenhood to teenagehood, you had this relationship with nature, but you also were stimulated both by your parents and by nature to have some intellectual pursuits. And you wound up studying at Berkeley. And little did they know that Wilderness Ranger would be, somebody from Berkeley, I guess. But how's that a contrast between, your early life experiences and now being on a large university campus, looking at different ideologies and ideas and disciplines?
I loved it so much. I guess when I decided to wade into humanity, I really wanted to wade in. And so Berkeley was just a dreamy place for me because the span of courses I could take in anthropology and all kinds of histories of all the vast cornucopia of folks who make up this United States was beautiful to me. And I also landed in a place that didn't shy away from making strong political statements. And so I had my first experience with civil disobedience there during a protest against apartheid in 85. I was one of the first 38 folks happened upon a protest and was able to be involved and able to sit down and block some doors, and learned so much from that process and from having that small act reflected in Bishop Desmond Tutu showing up on the campus and, you know, giving his love to those students. And it ended up being hundreds who were arrested there. Your idea of what the impact of something you can do is, you might get a glimpse into that. It might give you hope.
Is this an important juncture to understand how, again, your love for nature and the physical world combines with this sense of obligation to fellow humanity, so to speak? Are the somehow the two? I got the feeling from looking at your memoir that the two are closely related. It's almost sublime, to be quite honest, the way you convey it in your book.
Oh, that's really kind of you to say. I hadn't thought about that as much, and I think that's a beautiful point to make. When I was in high school, I read a lot of existentialism. I had a pretty decent English teacher, and I began to think a lot about, you know, what is the purpose of human life? And to me, being raised by atheists, you know, I had to really come up with something. I didn't have anywhere to go to decide that. And so the idea that a person's life maybe ultimately could be best served by making other lives better, by making increasing the happiness in the world, increasing the beauty in the world, and what makes life good for others. That was what I landed on. And I guess I did very much see that in the value of living things, and that they too should have free and safe and long lives.
And we'll get to that commitment, particularly extended to other human beings on your part. But allow me to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, also in HD in that format. And the hour is We the People. My guest is Cole Lefevre. Cole Lefevre is an activist, an award-winning journalist, a writer, and she's done quite a bit of public service. In 2004, Cole Lefevre became the first openly LGBTQ plus member of the Idaho legislature. We're having a conversation about land, the love of people, how we all evolve, and queer resistance, all packaged in rural America and this wonderful guest of ours today. We'll shift gears then, where you're getting to embrace protest. When we get the impression from your memoir that it's very consuming, very orientating to just about everything you're doing. How you're coming out of college and to full adulthood. How do you place that energy? I've already talked about you being a lookout for forest fires and a wilderness ranger, but how did you make your way back to Idaho and into public service?
I was not at all willing to leave Idaho. I had fallen in love with the land and the solitude and the beauty and the wildness that I had seen. And so every summer when I wasn't in school, I was working as a fire lookout. So those two things were simultaneous. And so when I finished school, I wanted to go back. And I had trained as a teacher. So I worked in Boise as a teacher and immediately looked for ways to become more engaged in policy and just making the place a little bit, I would say, safer and more respectful of both the wild and just people who don't look like that state legislature, which is super white and super male and super straight.
And that brings us to the point that I was talking about the complexity. Those are the stereotypes, not without reason, but you seem to be tasked with somehow making a way for yourself and for others like you. And what was it like at the time? What period of time are we talking about? There was some things that made the news in Idaho, referendums, public actions that were taken. But I like you to describe the eventual entree. What was going on around you, and what was going on with you, to create some call to justice.
In 1994, we, like a lot of Western states, faced some anti-gay referendums, ballot measures. And I happened to get a position as a staff coordinator on one of those. And we won that battle, which I think is surprising to a lot of people for a red state, that we would get enough voters to vote down an anti-gay initiative in 1994.
Was that Proposition 1? Some people might know the campaign No One Won.
Yep.
As in No One Proposition 1.
Yeah, in 1994. And I met a lot of really incredible people at that time and became kind of more enmeshed in the activist community there, which is a community that surprised me. There are so many queer people in red states in rural America who stay and live quiet lives or are deeply involved around a lot of issues. I mean, the people that I got to know worked on many things at once. They worked on the environment. They are the people who would show up at everything because it was a small city then. And
what are we talking about as far as small, just to give people an idea?
I think we only had like 200,000 people in the whole metro area, maybe 100,000 in the capital city itself. I think that's swollen to near 1 million now. So, but that also meant you could make a difference.
You had success. There was an nuclear waste protest. Nuclear waste from Nevada was going to be dumped into Shoshone. Band would be the Nawi, if I'm not mistaken. So nuclear waste was going to be put on First Nations land. And because of protest, which was not only local, but it was international scope, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and it was the anniversary of Columbus. Yeah. And so folks were taking the opportunity to gather at the test site, and they came from all over the world because the above ground and below ground nuclear testing was, you know, considered a threat to the whole world. And there had been generations of protests there, and celebrities had been arrested. And I had this group of 10 people, and we did it. We made these flyers to try and say that the site should be converted to solar power and save jobs for the folks working there, but that the nuclear waste testing should end. And we snuck through a culvert and crossed the desert, headed for the town of Mercury, hoping to post our flyers. But we, like hundreds of others that night, were arrested, caught by Wackenhut security in their night vision goggles and Humvees. But miraculously, and again, I think I'm one of those people who must just show up in that timing window, but testing did end after that. And while there's discussion in the Trump administration of reviving it, just the beauty of being able to see the impact of something that you participated in, and to just see those numbers of a protest swell to the point that it does make the difference is a powerful thing to remember, that when we throw our bodies into the cause and others are leading and we show up, it can make that difference.
And with that, it makes me wonder about something. People don't pop out of nowhere. They kind of establish themselves, particularly in Idaho. Are there two kinds of people? Maybe I'm simplifying it. Those who are determined to exploit nature and are so grounded in their thinking or their being, and those who want to uphold nature and that's grounded in their thinking and their being. What I'm musing about is, how can you be in the proximity of something so beautiful? And we haven't even gotten to the point about relating to other human beings. We'll get to that. But how can you be so close to the beauty of nature and yet want to ruthlessly exploit it?
I think maybe one of the more surprising things is that I live in a small town now, just at the edge of that wilderness area I used to work in. And people here do love the land, but they like to get there on their motors. And the idea that their access has an impact that is negative on that wilderness, that their desire to use a chainsaw or bring a generator has an impact, is uncomfortable, I think. I mean, we all like to think that our way of living on the land is respectful. But I think we all could also look at the ways we disrupt and we could be more respectful. So it's a level of degree. I've had a lot of people ask me if people in Challis, Idaho hate the land and want to destroy it. And I can say pretty unequivocally, no. We've had a really massive threat of having our public lands sold off for development all across the nation. All these public lands, from Forest Service lands to Bureau of Land Management lands, which also are equally as spectacular and wild in their own ways. But the people here don't want to see that happen. They don't want gated communities and mansions by the high lakes or the forests to be cut down. And to me, it's very much like the rest of my work. I would rather take what they do love and use what they do respect as a bridge to try to get us all to work together to make that change.
And we'll talk about that bridge, but we're at the halfway point in our show. We're talking to Cole Lefevre. Cole Lefevre is an activist, an award-winning journalist, writer, and importantly, she's spent much of her life in public service, particularly as the first openly LGBTQ+ member of the Idaho legislature. And we're definitely going to be talking about that experience once we come back from these public service announcements that we do here at WPFW. So stick with us, and we'll be back to continue our conversation right after this.
WPFW continues to celebrate our 50th year with another benefit concert at the Palisades Hub, Sunday, June 14th, from 4 till 6 p.m. You can enjoy live jazz music by Washington area-based artists while helping to keep jazz and justice on the air. Sets by Amy K. Bormet on piano and voice, plus saxophonist Elijah Jamal Balbed with his quartet and special guest vocalist. Tickets on Eventbrite via the link on our homepage, wpfwfm.org. WPFW, building a better world, one live performance at a time.
And welcome back. Welcome back to WPFW 89.3 FM, also in HD. WPFWFM.org, and you get the service of more than 100 programmers who bring you jazz and justice music and public affairs. There are plenty of good reasons to support this station. I'm glad several listeners have found that to be the case. I want to give a shout out to my colleagues at Inside Out. That's broadcast on Mondays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Further dealing with LGBTQ plus concerns and issues that involve all of us, not just a particular group. It's all of humanity that we brace here at WPFW. And that's an important point, particularly in these harsh and challenging times. Our guest on We the People is Cole Lefevre. Cole Lefevre, again, is an activist, a journalist, a writer. And we're going to now dive into a little bit of her experience of public service, particularly as she was the first openly queer member of the Idaho legislature. And I don't know if I've done a good job on talking about your evolution of, I'll call it empathy, the reasonableness that you believed that was held in good faith between people to do something constructive for their community. Why did you begin the odyssey? Why, if I'm overlooking something, forgive me, but how did you come about first running for the Idaho House of Representatives and then later on the Senate?
I started after we had that win defeating the anti-gay initiative. I started working more closely with the legislature, realizing that in our state, we had no right to public accommodation. We could be refused service in any business. We could be fired from our jobs. We could lose our housing, be denied an education. And I knew that that issue, along with a lack of laws addressing hate crimes, were really important. And my mom was an out queer woman who loved jazz and had an incredible jazz collection and was running a cafe with her partner in rural America. It's the place I live now, in Challis. But I really wanted to make a difference and began taking people into the Capitol, high school students and PFLAG parents and all kinds of folks, just to try and educate lawmakers. Well, I began to realize I needed to spend an awful lot more time doing that to make any dent in the lack of understanding that people had. I mean, people sometimes, when we'd walk up to them, the lawmakers in the building would say they'd never met anyone queer. And so there was a lot of room to expand their understanding of the problems that queer people faced in jobs and in living in small communities, especially. So I was encouraged by some folks to run for office. I had an incredible group of people who came together to make that possible. Being a community organizer, as I was, makes it a little easier to run for office. You understand the legwork it takes and the door knocking, the endless door knocking, and unfortunately the fundraising as well. But small donations from people you've worked with, people who know you've done the work, really make a difference. If you've been active in a community, you are going to have a much better chance of running for office and successfully, because people know your track record. I think it's more important what people have done than what, you know, they kind of say they're going to do. So that was helpful. I had worked on all kinds of other issues as well: public transportation, fighting welfare reform, tax policy issues, tax justice, economic justice. So I did run that race and was successful with the help of a really large group of wonderful people. And many of them were people of color as well, because the number of people represented in the legislature was really few at the time. And so my race, just getting some perspectives in there from people who had faced any form of discrimination was really important. The number of women, the number of people of color, folks of different religious backgrounds. And so we worked together as a community to make sure we began to see more diversity in the voices that were making the laws for our state. That's so essential.
Idaho is heavily populated by Latter-day Saints, as well the commonly referred to as the Mormon Church. And through the history of that state, they had experienced discrimination too, even though they're, I won't say they're a predominating culture, but they certainly, you correct me if I'm wrong, if not quite a majority, they're definitely a strong segment of the state population.
And it's a particularly fascinating situation because LDS folks do missions in other countries, and many have a lot of exposure to being, you know, a minority white person in a population that is, you know, completely different in its religious background or racial background. And I like the fact that that does sometimes broaden their minds. And I, you know, not a real fan of, you know, people trying to force their religion on others. But I had very positive experiences working with a lot of my LDS colleagues in the state house once I was elected. And at this point in time, it's really interesting to see the tension between some of those colleagues who really believed in family and were not necessarily heavily anti-abortion or anti-gay, but really did want to follow their church doctrine, which says that being gay is a sin. They were, I would say, not the type of people to push anti-gay policy. And even to this day, I feel at times provide a moderating force, whereas at one time I saw them as really a difficult block to overcome because they are not only, they were not, at the time I was in there, they slowly became a majority of the Republican Party, which, you know, our legislature is like 13 Democrats and, you know, 90 some Republicans. So I was in a very, very small minority of a small minority in there. And it's interesting to me how quickly I understood my job was to work with Republicans to try to make change. That if I didn't change minds, like hold, you know, pool nights, dinners at my house, get to know my colleagues, nothing was going to change. And I spent 8 years working very, very hard to get close and break through some of the walls and the prejudices and the misunderstandings that existed. And I would say that part, I think the changing minds part went really well. It was the changing votes that became hard.
So there's a difference. It's one thing to think or have a privately held conviction or commitment, is another to practice it publicly. I just wanted to line that out. There's several reasons for that. Something that I overlooked is what you share of your life lends testimony to seeing differences with people, but accepting those differences. And again, Idaho is a very white state. It's known for various degrees of whiteness that are not very pleasant, including white supremacy. And it's hard to not be distracted by that, to say the least. But it's another to understand when people say, we don't have a problem. We don't have a problem with this group or that. Or we don't have a problem with gay folks or folks of color or this issue or that. That's the city or that's another part of the country. But I don't want to put you in the hot seat, but that has to be reinforced somehow. That's what I'm wondering about. You can have all the civility you want, but like you said, you were operating in the state legislature, and I'm talking a bit too long, considering I'm croaking here. But you were operating at a time where nationally the sensibility about gay folk was changing toward a positive direction. But as we know, as I know, as a black person, you can have a national law, but it doesn't change your on the ground experiences when you're in a store, when you're being served or not served, where you want to live, what kind of job you have, and so on and so forth. Do you have any further explanation? I prattled a little bit too long, but how is such a system preserved, quite frankly?
My experience is that individuals may break through their prejudices or may change their hearts towards something, but that churches and political parties can be incredibly forceful factors in how they're willing to vote. And when I was in the legislature, I know that the LDS Church had a very, very strong opinion about whether marriage between a man and woman should occur. And they saw passing rights to public accommodation, employment, and housing as the camel's nose under the tent, they'd say, or the slippery slope. So they just blocked everything. Now, while people may change in the presence of real human relationships, they, you know, may understand that their prejudices are wrong, they have to interact with people on a really face-to-face basis for that to become powerful enough for them to really stand up. And even then, if they're pushing against, if they're an elected official and they're pushing against a political party that says, you vote that way and we are going to run somebody against you in the primary, that's unfortunately very powerful. But the most beautiful thing you see are those people who say, that's okay. I'll serve the one term. I'll do the right thing. What you are pushing here is wrong, and I won't stand for it, and I won't be part of it. And we need a lot more of that political courage here right now, because our legislature for the longest time felt like it was on the verge of, and our whole state felt like it was on the verge of putting white supremacy behind it. We had destroyed Richard Butler's compound in the northern part of the state, and those folks had dispersed. The idea of, you know, being overtly racist was despicable and publicly said to be despicable. And now we see these people entering the legislature, these people moving into our state in masses who have come here specifically because it is pretty white in a lot of places in the North. And those attitudes in the North are rising again. And I have been so deeply concerned about the trajectory of our state. But I will say something. We had a primary election last week where five of the eight of those leaders of that in the legislature lost their seats. Five of the eight were taken out by more moderate Republicans who are not white nationalists. And I cannot say how meaningful that is to me and to hundreds of thousands of us here in the state who are done with them taking over our legislature and our communities.
So I'm mindful that we're running out of time. To achieve much in a political process, sometimes you play by the rules, but in every day and age, there comes a point where there are no rules, or better put, there's not an exercise of empathy, of goodwill, of reasoning with each other. What brought you to protest? What brought you to civil disobedience? And how did it show up while you were in the legislature?
Well, they wouldn't even give us a hearing on a bill to include four words, sexual orientation, comma, gender identity, in our state human and civil rights laws. Wouldn't even listen to stories. And that went on for about 5 years where they wouldn't even put the bill up for the community to testify on.
So what were you asking for? Just to make it clear to our audience, because one group of people would say there were laws in the books, gay and queer people are protected, and that you found out that you didn't find out, you lived out that that wasn't the case.
My colleagues even thought there were federal protections for LGBTQ people, but there weren't, and it was important to educate them on that. To this day, in Idaho, we have no right to public accommodation right now, you know, and nobody is enforcing any kind of federal case law. But in 2012, we realized we had to make the world look, make our state look at what was happening in the legislature and educate people. So we began with a sticky note campaign, which believe it or not, is a violation of the rules of the House and Senate, is to put affix any item to the windows or the doors of the building. And of course they made it policy that we would be banished or arrested if we did. And so
on officials' doors or the chamber or committee rooms or what have you?
All of the above. We started with one committee room, and the next year we did the entire Capitol, all the glass windows of the doors, and thousands of people came to post the notes, and we got notes from every town in the state, and those were put in the Capitol building where they couldn't fail to see them. So people were able to testify on these little squares of paper, and yet we would post them, we'd stick them up there, and the security would come and take them down. So we'd post more and more. That went on for another year and still no hearing. They had.
And again, you were asking, given Idaho's laws, to add four words. So this was the Add the Words campaign.
Yes.
And can you explain to the listeners what that meant? What were you trying to do?
So Add the Words was a phrase we used in 2011 and 2012 to just say, we're asking for passage of a law that includes sexual orientation and gender identity in the existing human and civil rights laws of the state. Just add those four words and say in law that discrimination is wrong. And the sitting leaders of the House and Senate refused. And even after thousands of people testified on pieces of you know, paper stuck to windows, they wouldn't do it.
And the testimony attested to homelessness, suicide, jobs, being fired from jobs, not being able to use certain stores. Did I miss anything?
Yeah, evictions. A friend of mine who's a trans librarian here in Chalice was fired. And all across the state, law enforcement officers, people in all kinds of different professions were afraid to come out, were afraid they'd slip in a conversation at work. That's still true to this day because no one enforces that and no one will here. But in the face of that, I realized I couldn't stay and be part of a legislature that was cutting services for people with disabilities, refusing to stop forms of discrimination they knew were going on, wouldn't fund schools, wouldn't fund mental health and substance abuse treatment. It was a little bit too devastating after 8 years to stay and be part of that. And when I served, I very much used the term we. When we passed a law, even if I voted no, we passed that law. I was part of the body that passed the law. And it is soul-wrenching to be part of a body that does great harm, that attempts to drive people from the state with policy that is cruel and terrorizing. So I left and knew I had to come back and make it so that what they were doing wasn't invisible, that more people could see what was happening in those chambers and how their refusal was impacting beautiful people.
Well, the price you paid and the price that these people paid, your colleagues, were multiple arrests and a social sanction, to say the least. I'm mindful that we just have a few minutes in the remainder of our show. You know, public service, your service, and the sacrifice of others who protest comes at great cost. What do you think the future holds? Do you think these efforts have secured any traction, any grounding for a better future?
I feel very strongly that we do have a duty to disobey unjust laws, that no one should stand alone in disobeying or making a spectacle of an unjust law, that when some are targeted for harm, we all have to stand up with them. And I have been fortunate enough to have hundreds of people stand with me for LGBTQ rights in Idaho, and to see the eyes of the world turn towards those lawmakers who refused to help. I think this time now calls for that more than any time in my lifetime. And our silence and our waiting for someone to call for action, I think, is difficult for all of us. It's going to have to come.
And thankfully, you weren't alone. You had support. I will be frank, from what I know of your memoir, you've paid a price. But it's a commitment we all need to make, I guess. So, Cole Lefevre, I thank you. Again, the author of In the Arms of Mountains, a memoir of land, love, and queer resistance in rural America. Thank you for spending the hour with us talking about a special part of our country, quite frankly, and to even offer some hope that needful change will come. I thank you for being with us.
Thank you, David. It's really been a pleasure.
All right. My thanks to Brian Bernard, our engineer, the News and Public Affairs Department at WPFW. And most importantly, if you can hear through my creaking voice, you, the listener, are greatly appreciated. Thank you for supporting this show and WPFW. Coming up next, don't forget the blues with Clarence the Blues Man Turner at 1 o'clock Africa Now with Moussa Mutali. Thank you for listening and take care. Six new moons of the year. He pockets our blood and our sweat, leaves us to our tears. More, 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 lawmakers cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. Shall not stand down. Will not be your clown. All the flame burning bright. Who perish not? We the people.
Kingmaker's prophet on his dusty old throne.
His dusty old throne.
Deep, deep purple mantle on shriveled skull and bone. And the high court beauticians paint his bloodless cheeks red.
His bloodless cheeks red.
But them with eyes can see the king is dead.
Heartfelt thank you to all our WPFW donors, both new and returning, for your incredible support during our recent spring pledge drive. Your generosity helps amplify the sounds of emancipatory music and movements. If you haven't had the chance to donate yet, now is the time. Please visit WPFWFM.org to help us close the $79,000 gap between our goal and what we've raised. It's listeners like you who keep a song in our heart and independent music and journalism thriving at WPFW, ensuring that jazz and justice reach everyone. Thank you for being part of our community.
DC Abortion Fund, Burger Sounds, and Noise for Now present the fourth annual My Body, My Festival on Thursday, May 28th at the 930 Club, featuring Yaya Bey, Barty Strange, Nourished by Time, Deacon, Hamilton Lighthouser, and Cherub Tree. Info at mybodymyfestival.com.
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAHWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 24th DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 5th to the 11th at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema, discussions with filmmakers, opening night reception celebrating 60 years of independence for Barbados and Guyana, and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 5th to the 11th. Information at afi.com/silver, afi.com/silver, or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.